Session number 5210, Reel 1.
Mr. Bainbrough, Reel 1. When did you first join the Navy, Mr. Bainbrough?
Oh, in 1938, January. In fact, it was when Neville Chamberlain came back with a bit of paper, Peace in Our Time. I think everybody knew that it was inevitable there was going to be a war.
So this was the time of Munich?
The time of Munich, yes.
Why did you decide to join the Navy rather than one of the other services?
Well, I even as a small boy, it was always my intention to join the Navy. And I did try earlier, and my father said I should wait until I was 21. And he was convinced that I would probably change my mind by that time. But nevertheless, when I did join, I did it unbeknown to him. And I think he realized as well, because he said, well, you seem to have your idea on joining the Navy. So he signed the form and that was it. And I was allowed to go to Devonport and pass the examination.
What type of work did you take up in the Navy?
Oh, I was a writer in the accountant branch. I passed the examination for writer.
Now, we can't go into your early service and training.
No.
But in 1939,
yes,
you got a posting to Hong Kong.
I did, yes.
Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes, I got a draft sheet. A draft. In fact, they asked me where did I want to go, and I said anywhere, preferably in the Far East. And a couple of weeks later, I had a draft to join HMS Dorsetshire in Hong Kong.
Why did you want to go to the Far East?
Well, I was interested. I was always an adventurous type, and I thought, well, it's silly being in the Navy, being in at home, and so I wanted to go to the Far East.
And What was your ship whilst you were at Hong Kong?
Well, when I got to Hong Kong, HMS Dorchester was a cruiser, and I was transferred from Dorsetshire to a base, HMS Tamar, which was the base in Hong Kong. Another man took my job on the Dorsetshire, and then I went to HMS Tamar.
So it wasn't a ship at all, it was a land base?
Well, it was an old ship alongside the jetty.
What kind of a ship was it?
Well, it was a very old ship. It was the base where we looked after all the accounts. We had a submarine squadron there. We had 8 destroyers, 3 cruisers, and then all the base of Royal Marines as well as Royal Naval personnel. And I was looking after the pay in the pay office of all these people.
What kind of a warship had Tamar been?
Tamar was an old warship, a wooden warship. Very, very old. But it was used just for accommodation purposes.
What was it like working on the Tamar?
Oh, it was quite good. Quite good working on the Tamar, which was alongside the wall. And, of course, some of us were able to sleep at the top of the peak in accommodation up there, and I took advantage of that because it was rather nice to sleep shoresides, which is what I did. But as well as our duties as writer, we did small arms training at Stonecutters under the supervision of a Royal Marine sergeant. And my speciality was Lewis gun. In fact, I was put number one on a Lewis gun. And I did hold this position, in fact, at the time of the Japanese invasion.
Can you tell me what life in peacetime Hong Kong was like just before the Japanese war started for the British servicemen out there?
Well, it was quite good. In fact, for a time, it was very, very different from the war from UK and from the war in UK. There was no austerity, but I know we used to have funds and collections. In fact, I think Hong Kong, in fact, bought a Lancaster squadron out of personal donations. But the life in Hong Kong during that period was, in fact, quite good. Until, of course, December 1941, Pearl Harbor Day.
Why was life so good in Hong Kong, more specifically?
Well, things were cheap. A packet of cigarettes was 10 cents. A dollar was one and threepence in those days. And you could get a meal in a restaurant very cheaply. The cost of living generally, tram fares, and then we had facilities as well for swimming, motorboat outings. We used to go to Big Wave Bay every Thursday afternoon on Make and Mend Day, and generally speaking, life was quite good.
Did the training of the British servicemen in Hong Kong seem to be hard and adequate before the war started?
Oh, I'm sure it was. Everybody was trained in some way or other which was best suited, because when I went to Stonecutters, which was the Royal Marine Small Arms Department, everybody was weeded out, and they were chosen for the job which they considered best suited. And that's why I was a Lewis gunner. My eyesight was good. And in fact, I was a junior rating, a leading writer, and my number two was, in fact, senior to me. He was a petty officer. But because my eyesight was probably better than his, I was chosen to be number one.
So you don't think the life in Hong Kong was too soft for the British servicemen before the Japanese war started?
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't. I think everybody was very, very well-trained, and everybody knew exactly what to do.
Now, you've already said that you were in Hong Kong when the Japanese war started.
Yes.
In December 1941. Mm. Can you describe in as much detail as possible how you saw the battle for Hong Kong personally?
Yes. We used to do cipher duties, and I was selected for cipher duties. All the writers, and as the messages came through, they were numbers, of course, and then we had to refer to the necessary book for coding, and the numbers were deducted from the appropriate page on the code. And then after the answers then were decoded again from another book. And on the very day of the Japanese war starting, I was on duty in the cipher office. And in fact, when the message came through, I got the message through. And as far as I remember, it was very brief, and it was something: Tokyo, fair wind to fine, Tokyo, repeat Tokyo. Well, that to me didn't make any sense, and the duty officer, I got hold of him, and then he decoded that from another book. And having done that, he said, "Well, it looks to me as if the war is here. The Japanese have declared war. Or the Pearl Harbor's been attacked, so we must be prepared for anything that happened." Very soon after that, Japanese bombers were over Hong Kong.
Can you describe how you saw the battle for Hong Kong personally?
We had to open up a base in a hospital on the other side of the island. And lots of stores and equipment and everything was taken over there. And I went with them. But then, of course, I took my Lewis gun together with the, and it was detailed on where to go. And I was, for a time, in Aberdeen side of Hong Kong and attached to some Canadians because there were two regiments of Canadians in Hong Kong, the Royal Rifles of Canada and the Winnipeg Grenadiers. And I was attached, together with various other groups, to a Canadian officer, and I went with him on the hills.
What impression did you get of these Canadian units?
Oh, very efficient. The officer in charge was an excellent fellow, excellent chap. And it looks to me as if he was told what to do. He knew that he had to cover a certain area in case of Japanese invasion. And I went with him. We had a lot of activity with Japanese bombers and fighters. They were strafing us and dropping bombs all around. And after a while also, they were dropping mortars. The Japanese are very clever at mortars. They could drop a mortar from several hundred yards and within a few feet of where they wanted it to drop. I remember we had to move out of this base to the gateway, and the Japanese were dropping mortars in the gateway, and we had to judge as near as possible by the mortars dropping, to run across and then duck down quickly to get out, which is what we did.
Did you suffer any casualties?
No, I didn't. I didn't. Personally, I wasn't hit at all. Many people were. We were moved from different places. Later, I had to go to another place, and a Jap plane was over, strafing us with the machine gun. And we certainly had shots at this one. And of course, the plane, in fact, was shot down. But nobody knows who did it.
Whereabouts was that?
That was on the other side of the island from the main HMS Tamer. The Japs knew we were there because we were firing at them. And then they came to try and get us. And so I know I fired my Lewis gun. And it appeared to me that they were going straight into the cockpit. But of course, it's difficult to say who actually got the pilot. But at least I thought, well, I did my job as well by contributing in some way with my Lewis gun to the Japs. Later, we went to a place which was called Wong Nei Chung Gap. And when we went up there, we found that a previous lorry had gone up there with naval personnel on board, and they were shot up, ambushed, and a dozen or so sailors were killed in the previous lorry. And I went on the lorry after that, but the Japs had gone then somewhere else. It seemed to me that I was very lucky. I could have easily been in that first lorry. But I did hear afterwards that from a survivor of the first lorry that there was a Chinese road up sign near Wong Nei Chung Gap, and the Chinese was directing the lorry to go on the outer side of the road to get past this sign, And he swore that that was done solely so that the lorry was in the machine crossfire from the Japs at each side of the hill as they approached the area. And so they shot everybody up, and they caught them completely by surprise. And I think there was only one or two got out of that.
You mean it was suspected that this Chinese was a fifth columnist?
Absolutely, yes.
Did there seem to be any other evidence of a Japanese fifth column in Hong Kong?
Well, yes. I knew that there was a hotel in Hong Kong called the Chitose, and it was a bar with Japanese women used to be in this place. And it was more or less like a dance hall. And I went there a couple of times, but I do know that a petty officer Hunt, who was with me later, and he was captured by the Japs just a short time before the end, before the capitulation. And he told us afterwards that when the Japs caught him, he was interviewed by an interpreter, and the interpreter, no less, was one of the girls from the Chitose, who he knew quite well. And yet she was the one who was interviewing him in front of the Japs. He did survive, this Petty Officer Hunt. In fact, he's still alive today. But he did tell us that one of the girls from the Chitose Hotel, was in fact the very girl who interviewed him, wanted more information or any information they could get about his job or anything that was... They were particularly, I think, interested in knowing, getting hold of anybody who knew anything about where the mines were laid for the Jap ships coming into the harbour.
What happened to you after you went to the Wong Yi Chung Gap?
After the Wong Yi Chung Gap, I then went into the dockyard. I was detailed. We had to go into the dockyard in Hong Kong. Back into the dockyard. By this time, the dockyard was under shell fire from the mainland. And it was... We just had to remain there together in groups until a naval officer, a lieutenant commander, came along and said that I was to take my gun in an area and put it down in one corner, and all the others did likewise. And he said that the war was over, as far as we were concerned. He'd been informed by higher authority that the guns were to be laid down in this area in the dockyard, which is what I did. And then a Japanese cruiser came in, and we could see the Japanese flag. And very shortly after that, a Japanese soldiers and appeared at the entrance of the dockyard and then came into the dockyard.
What was the reaction of the British forces in Hong Kong when they heard that you were surrendering?
Well, of course we knew that all the submarines had left. We knew that the destroyers had left for the Mediterranean area. And our impression was that the biggest enemy at the time was the Germans. And it looked to me as if all efforts were to be made against the Germans in preference to Hong Kong. In fact, I think it was stated quite clearly afterwards that the Germans was the main enemy, and after that was dealt with, then Hong Kong, then the Japanese, all efforts would then be transferred to the Far East. There was one destroyer, HMS Scout, still in Hong Kong, and I heard that she, in fact, got out and took the gold from the gold bullion that was in Hong Kong and run the gauntlet against the Japanese Navy and arrived home a long time later. But we only had three planes in Hong Kong, three Catalinas, very, very slow flying. Of course, they didn't last long against the Japanese. We had no planes and no ships to speak of except West River gunboats.
Except what?
West River gunboats. And they were flat-bottomed boats that were just for going up the river. HMS Tarantula, Sakala, Moth, Tern, Robin. And we also had some MTBs, but they were soon destroyed by the Japs.
Can you describe your first meeting with the Japanese?
Well, the first meeting, we were all kept together at the Fall Inn under supervision of our own officers. And then the Japanese came in and we were divided into groups. I was taken to a place, North Point, called North Point, which was on the island. And it was a sort of a North Point. Wooden huts had been there, but all the wooden huts had been burnt and looted, no doubt. And they'd been under fire as well from the Japanese. Because when we got there, all the huts, there were no roofs on the huts. And it was just a mass of splintered wood. But we went in there, and then the Japs said that we were to build these huts, and we were to build them the best we can, and we were to live in them.
Can you describe the building of the huts?
Well, of course, the wood and nails and hammers shortage, but we did, after a few days, rebuild the huts, the structures, even though not fully, because they were not watertight, and most of us, in fact, were sleeping outside on blankets. But after a while, as I say, we did get a roof on, even though they were leaked. And we stayed there for 2 or 3 months, during which time the Japanese, to begin with, only brought in rice. No soup, there was no vegetables of any description. And in fact, we called it rice bust, which is an army expression meaning rice and nothing else. And after 2 or 3 months of rice bust, that began to tell its tale. Everybody had constipation in those days. And it was then also that some deaths started. Then they brought in some beans. And a doctor said that these soya beans were very, very hard, unpalatable, and suggested that they should be laid down on wet sacks and in order to try to get them to germinate by getting little bean shoots to grow. There'd be more nourishment in that. But in fact, the they were rotten after a while. It wasn't very successful. And then we got yeast. We got a yeast ration. Somebody got some yeast and started to grow it. And then we all had a ration of yeast, which was about an egg cup full every day. Once they started the yeast to grow, it started. We had a ration given to us. But it was pretty grim in those days.
How did the Japanese treat you in North Point?
Well, a lot of beating up, of course, and we had trader horns in those days. We used to call them trader horns. Somebody would go into a hut and find if anybody had got anything to sell or flog, and then he would take it and go around the whole camp buying and selling things for people. And for instance, if you had two pairs of shoes or two pairs of boots, or you only wanted one, you'd give a pair of boots to a trailer horn and he would take it into another hut, and then he would return and say, well, somebody will give you 5 cigarettes for it.
Did you say they were called trader horns?
Trader horns, yes.
Why horns?
Well, because Trader Horn is a book, isn't it? A story. That when I was a boy, I remember it was quite prominent. A Trader Horn was the name of this book. And so we just call them Trader Horns.
Is that Horn with an E on the end?
No, H-O-R-N. Trader Horn was somebody in Africa, I think. And he was a trader. And they call these people trader horns. Now, this is interesting because I had a leather suitcase. And I'd struggled with this leather suitcase. But it was quite a good one. But the thing is that the suitcase weighed far heavier than anything I had in it. And a Canadian officer saw the case and he wanted it. And he said he would be prepared to give me 90 cigarettes for it. Which is what I did. I gave him my suitcase and I had 90 cigarettes. And then I had a rugby jersey, which I tied up the neck, tied up the two sleeves, turned it inside out, and there was a kit bag. And I could put my bits and pieces in that, which was far better than having to carry a leather suitcase. It was fortunate because after a while we were segregated again and taken onto a barge across to New Territories to Champchapeau camp. When we got to Champchapeau, we all marched along under the Japanese guards on each side to Champchapeau, where we stayed until September 1942.
Can you describe Champchapeau?
Champchapeau, when we got there, the deaths were quite prominent then, because dysentery and diphtheria was rife. And I know diphtheria really is a disease which affects children. But men, when their resistance is very low, they can also contract diphtheria just the same as children can. We had many deaths from diphtheria. And of course, there was no medicine. There was nothing given. We were bearing about 8 a day in Champchapeau. But I must say that when I first went there, my 90 cigarettes, they proved very useful to me because I was able to acquire a pair of boots and a shirt and various other things which I needed.
Who from?
Well, from various people who had more boots than they required, And if somebody had two pairs, he only wanted one, and then he would give me one, and I would give him, say, five or six cigarettes for him.
Was there any contact with civilians outside the wire?
Yes. Now, after a while, they brought electric wires around Champipo, and Chinese people used to come and throw things over the wire to people that they knew inside. Chinese women and men, but of course they always did it when the Japanese guards were away, because the Japanese guards would catch them occasionally and...